Okay, it's loading. Okay, whoops.
So I also have no relationships to disclose. What I'm going to be speaking about is improvising philanthropy in 1900s in New York, creative models for financing public health. What I'm going to talk about is five examples of private-public partnerships in public health during the Progressive Era. Why? I believe it is interesting and important to think about what conditions gave rise to these partnerships, how their goals were defined, and how they were structured and funded, and what ramifications they had for public health in the short and long run, and what we can learn from these partnerships that has relevance today for private-public partnerships in public health. To begin, a variety of cultural, social, economic, and political factors combined in the pre-progressive era of New York City to create the background for the partnerships I will discuss this afternoon. Primary among those factors, and some of these were mentioned by Marion in her talk, urbanization as New York State became 82% urbanized by 1920, immigration as Manhattan's foreign-born population tripled from 1870 to 1910, density, which increased tenfold in the most crowded wards of the city over the same period, industrialization, as New York became the largest U.S. manufacturing, trade, and finance center, growth in income disparities, as 1% of the population controlled 20% of the wealth, and two-thirds of laborers lived in substandard conditions, and finally, professionalization, as by 1910, 3% of 18-year-olds entered college, and graduate schools began to train the first generation of social reformers. Culturally, New Yorkers were questioning the endemic corruption in municipal government, the traditional division of the city's impoverished into the worthy and unworthy poor, the laws which prohibited city-funded outdoor relief, that is, outside of city-sanctioned institutions, and the inability of private philanthropy to meet the burgeoning needs of the city's indigent population. These pressures caused new thinking about how to get things done. Some believe that, rather than just criticizing the government, they should join in and encourage reforms. An example is when at a meeting in May 1916, prior to formation of the Children's Home Bureau, philanthropist Adolf Louison said, "As governments develop and improve and truly represent the people, it is wisest to support a good government, and the wisest way of dispensing philanthropy is through the medium of the governmental agency." This was quite a change from earlier concepts of philanthropy, which generally sought to avoid and sometimes competed with government. Two professional social reformers who embraced Louison's thinking were Homer Folks and John Kingsbury, and shown here, and two philanthropists were Elizabeth Milbank Anderson and Anne Vanderbilt. Now, in brief, I will review five private-public partnerships in public health involving some or all of these individuals, and I will focus on how each partnership came to be, how it was organized, what its longer-term impact, if any, proved to be. My first example is the public bath movement. In 1900, less than 10% of the city's tenements had baths, and while the germ theory of disease was gaining ground, the miasma and dirt theories of disease causation lingered. Elizabeth Milbank Anderson's son had died of diphtheria, and she was persuaded by one of New York's oldest charities, the Association for Improving the Condition of the Poor, to build a new public bath which would serve as a model for a large number of city-built baths. Anderson's bath, which she gave to the AICP to manage, was completed in 1904 on First Avenue and East 38th Street, and could provide 4,400 free baths or showers per day, or 1.6 million per year. With the Milbank bath as a model, and with the assistance on site selection and architecture from the AICP, the city subsequently built 22 baths by 1919. This was a weak form of a private-public partnership, with public money following rather than being concurrent with private funds, and with each meeting their own capital and operating needs. There was no shared governing body, but the city did base its program on the private program. Unfortunately, none of these baths, private or public, ever operated at more than 19% of capacity. Cultural antipathy to bathing, the 5-cent cost for soap and a towel, fear of crime, the intimidating structures, all served to keep the target population away. The baths were overbuilt in quality and quantity. In effect, a failure to adequately identify real needs and design an appropriate solution led to a wasting of scarce public funds for a public health need. In 1925, the Milbank People's Bath was repurchased by Anderson's Milbank Memorial Fund from the AICP and converted into the Bellevue-Yorkville Community Health Center. My next example is a home hospital for the tubercular, founded in 1912 in the East River Homes, built by Ann Vanderbilt. In 1900, Manhattan had 30,000 poor residents with tuberculosis living in tenements. Many of the sick avoided sanatorium care in order to be able to stay with their families. Social reformers Homer Folks and John Kingsbury convinced Ann Vanderbilt and Anderson that a new solution needed to be tried, that of providing improved housing that would keep families together and improve their earnings power, provide on-site medical care and education in sanitary living habits to prevent disease transmission, and unify the patient, landlord, medical, and social worker communities toward a common goal of improved public health. Vanderbilt agreed in 1909 to contribute the $1 million construction cost of the East River Homes, in which would be housed the Home Hospital for the Tubercular, or HHT. And Vanderbilt and Anderson agreed to split the $100,000 annual operating cost. If successful, they hoped the city would eventually take over some of the operating cost, as the HHT would be in part the substituting for city-funded sanitarium care. In 1912, the HHT opened in the East River Homes on East 38th Street. Over 4 years, the number of families in the HHT grew from 20 to 80, with 400 members living in them by 1916. The daily subsidized cost per patient was 38% less than the average in 17 New York State tuberculosis sanatoria. An outside study in 1916 showed that 5.5% of the patients had died, 71% were well, and there were no new reported cases, which caused the AICP to deem the program a success. Based on these results, when Kingsbury left the AICP and became City Commissioner of Public Charities, he set up a private-public partnership in 1916, with the city funding 50% of the HHT's $100,000 annual operating cost. Hence, this followed a hybrid funding model of private capital and private-public shared contribution to the operating costs. However, some problems arose. The fairly expensively built facility, the lack of a unified governing committee, mismanaged relations with the medical community, which preferred to keep patients under their complete control in sanatoria, and mismanaged publicity contributed to this program's political vulnerability. Discharged families did not secure permanent above-average incomes. The subsidized cost was high on a per-family basis, and criticism arose concerning the city's payment for outdoor relief. When Tammany Hall candidate John Hyland won the 1917 mayoral election, he claimed that the city was funding a private endeavor, that the city was a victim of the charity trust, that it would cost the city $16 million to care for all tubercular families similarly, and that the HHT was neither a home nor a hospital. Hyland moved in early 1918 to evict the 400 HHT tenants from the East River Homes and end the city payments there too. Elizabeth Milbank Anderson came forward in March 1918 with an economized solution for 100 of the 400 HHT tenants, most of whom refused to enter sanatoria, through the purchase of the Victoria Apartments in the Bronx. And she and Ann Vanderbilt split the operating expenses. Anderson's foundation later assumed all the operating costs. In 1925, the program was ended due to a lack of suitable tenants. As a private-public partnership, the HHT did not fare well. Goals were confused between economic and medical considerations, and the project was not well managed or coordinated given the varying interests of multiple constituencies. However, the HHT did succeed from a longer-term perspective of demonstrating the feasibility of caring for TB patients in their homes, which became the standard of care in the 1930s. The next example is a school lunch program launched by the AICP. In 1904, William Wall of the Henry Street Settlement, I saw a picture of earlier in this presentation, she agitated for school lunches as a means of improving nutrition, school attendance, and performance. Many of the city's children suffered from rickets, a malformation of the bones caused by dietary deficiency, and from other nutritionally based diseases. In 1909, some of Anderson's friends, including Lillian Wall, created the School Lunch Committee to start a privately funded lunch program through the AICP in two city public elementary schools, later expanded to seven schools. In 1913, Anderson decided to give $650,000 to the AICP to fund a new Department of Social Welfare to address a number of city problems. And out of this, AICP manager Kingsbury convinced Anderson to become the lead donor to the school lunch program. The program eventually expanded by 1916 to 60 schools, feeding 25,000 children. Kingsbury, then the city's commissioner of public charities, stayed on as a member of the school lunch committee. And while private money funded the worker salaries and subsidized the food costs, the city paid for the school kitchen space and equipment. Here is a letter from Commissioner Kingsbury asking the mayor for $15,000 more for kitchen cooking equipment for this program. This was an interesting funding model, as the program's capital costs were funded with private money, excuse me, were funded with public money, while the operating expenses were funded by private money, the opposite of the usual model. When Mayor Mitchell lost the 1917 election, the new mayor, John Hyland, moved to shut down the school lunch committee and city contribution to the meal program. However, publicity of the program had been extensive and favorable, attendance and performance of school children had improved, and teacher and parent protests prevented Hyland from shutting down the program completely. Overruling the mayor, the city appropriated $50,000 in 1918 to fund the capital and operating costs in the 60 schools. However, Hyland did what he could to undermine the program, and by 1920 succeeded in cutting the number of schools served to 14. The record shows that in the United States, widespread taxpayer funding for school lunches for poor children did not occur until 1934 under the auspices of the Works Progress Administration of the Roosevelt Field. The New York School Lunch Private-Public Partnership had more success than the HHT. A single administrative committee with both private and public representatives successfully managed the operating problems. Publicity was wide and effective, and thought was given as to how to increase the scale of the program and secure funding. Ultimately, despite interim politically based opposition, school lunches were adopted as public policy. My next example is the Bronx Park Employment Program. This was a program that was an outgrowth of the recession which hit New York City with the outbreak of World War I. With the Allied blockade of Central Europe, trade dropped by 50%, and unemployment in the city grew by the hundreds of thousands. Unemployed workers crowded into lodging, costing 5 cents per night. The AICP received an increasing volume of applicants for assistance, at the same time it was looking for jobs for patients from the home hospital for the tuberculosis. One of the AICP managers saw that the city had recently acquired new land to expand the Bronx Zoological Park, but had insufficient funds to improve the property. He thought that if money could be found, perhaps an employment program could be worked out with the Parks Department. He gave the project to a young recruit who had been hired in the AICP's Anderson-funded Department of Social Welfare, named Harry Hopkins. Do you like that picture? Hopkins negotiated a public-private partnership with the Parks Commissioner in the Mitchell administration, whereby the AICP would pay the salaries and the park engineers would supervise the workers on public property. Hopkins raised $5,000 from Anderson's foundation and more from other AICP donors, and in 1915, 231 workers were hired, some from the HHT, to cut trees, build roads, and terrace the Bronx Park property. Again, this project followed a hybrid funding model, with the capital or parkland and equipment being provided through public taxes, and the operating expense or salaries funded by private donors. Interestingly, both the city and the AICP avoided publicity, and there was no formal committee overseeing the program with private and public representatives. According to internal AICP reports, the workers, parks engineers, and the AICP were all happy with the results. The engineers wrote the AICP asking for more funds to hire more workers in 1916 so that they could build walls along the post road and railings along the riverwalk. Unfortunately for this program, donors were distracted by war relief projects, and not enough money could be found to continue the program. thought had not been given at the inception of this initiative as to how it could be increased in size, and perhaps the failure of the AICP to seek publicity for the program reflected doubts from a society that valued self-sufficiency over governmental intrusion in the workplace, as well as concerns for the feasibility of long-term private funding of public jobs programs. However, there were no doubts in one person's mind. Harry Hopkins developed a firm conviction of the merits of public employment programs and demonstrated as much in the 1930s as manager of Roosevelt's Civil Works Administration and the Works Progress Administration, which together provided jobs to over 12 million workers during the Depression, illustrating a key link between Progressive Era and New Deal social programs. My last example is that of the Children's Home Bureau of the City Department of Public Charities. This private-public program received joint impetus from both city officials and private citizens. The outplacing of orphan children from city-sanctioned institutions to foster families dates back to at least 1853, with Charles Loring Brace's founding of the Children's Aid Society. Homer Folks of the State Charities Aid Association tried to establish an outplacement bureau in the 1901-03 reform administration of Mayor Seth Lowe. When Kingsbury left the AICP and became Commissioner of Public Charities in 1914, he and Mayor Mitchell decided to try once again to make outplacement city policy. In 1914, the city paid $3.2 million annually for the care of 23,000 abandoned children in largely Protestant, Jewish, and Catholic-run institutions. Commissioner Kingsbury investigated these institutions in 1914 and claimed that conditions in them were bad, the children ill cared for, and that the city's money was siphoned off for other religious purposes. He claimed many children ran away from the asylums and preferred to live in the streets or work in poor conditions. Many of Kingsbury's claims were later confirmed in the 1915-1916 Governor Strong Commission investigation of childcare institutions. John Kingsbury and Homer Folks believed these conditions could be improved by boarding out the city children with foster families with a city-paid subsidy. A change in 1916 in the outdoor relief law made this possible, and Kingsbury and Folks decided to detour around city civil service seniority rules, bureaucracy, and politics by setting up their Children's Home Bureau with private money. This would allow them to hire private employees without placing experience and launch their program quickly. Kingsbury obtained a pledge of $120,000 from Anderson and four others in order to fund the hiring of 33 employees who would administer the program, interview, inspect, and monitor prospective foster families, and give medical inspections and acquire new clothes for the children. On the city side, Kingsbury got the comptroller to move $40,000 from the institution's budget to the Home Bureau to fund the foster family subsidy payment of $3 per child per week. To oversee this private-public partnership, Kingsbury set up an advisory board of the Children's Home Bureau, which would advise the city department on management of the bureau, with Anderson, Homer Folks, and Kingsbury himself among the 15 members, all of whom were approved by the mayor. The city also agreed to provide office space for the 33 privately paid employees. Hence, this program was another funding hybrid, with capital costs in the form of office space and equipment paid for by the city, and operating expenses in the form of salaries, clothing, and maintenance stipends funded jointly out of private and public funds. In 1916, the employees were hired and prospective homes investigated, 87% of which were rejected as unsuitable. To the approved homes, from November 1916 to May 1917, the Bureau outplaced 600 children. By the end of 1917, a total of 1,000 children were placed with foster families. The children were on average visited quarterly by Bureau employees. In July 1917, proclaiming the program a success, Mayor Mitchell pushed through the Board of Aldermen a $120,000 allocation to cover all costs of the program. Anderson's money continued and was diverted to funding the cost of medical inspections of children coming under initial city supervision. Somewhat predictably, the outplacements caused a wave of protests from the religious institutions losing children and funding. Despite the careful structuring of the advisory board, the failure to include representatives of the affected religious institutions, adequately manage publicity, and acquire broad support, produced controversy over the Bureau's goals and significant resistance to the outplacing function. In particular, a number of Catholic priests attacked the motivations of their Catholic mayor. Among the many controversies, among the many controversies prompted by Mitchell's reformed government, no issue more than the Children's Home Bureau and that of child outplacement was responsible for his defeat in the 1917 mayoral election. In 1918, Mayor-elect Hyland shut down the Children's Home Bureau and the advisory board disbanded in June. About 500 of the outplaced children were returned to institutions. In terms of the impact of the Children's Home Bureau, however, it must be looked at within the context of a broader push to keep children in homes with their mothers. In 1915, the passage of the Child Welfare Act provided for state payments to widowed mothers, which eventually became the largest factor in lowering the in-institution child population from 73% of the state's indigent children in 1915 to 40% by 1925. To summarize, one might ask, did having a governing committee with representatives of the private and public constituencies make a difference to the effectiveness of each of these partnerships? Which ones had managers with clear authority to act? Which ones managed publicity well? Which of these programs could scale up to serve a wider population? Which of them had a long-term favorable outcome in public health? What elements of these programs inform planning for public-private partnerships today? While these programs were clearly products of their time, I believe they illuminate some trans-historical challenges inherent in private-public partnerships. One relates to, for any partnership, how the specific individuals involved weigh and trade off motivation, expediency, philosophy, image, and short and long-term goals, among other considerations. And I think now we're happy for questions.
First, and the contributions that they made to public health across actually the 20th century were pretty astounding. Not so much in terms of visiting nurses, but the data that they wound up sharing with public health, with medicine, epidemiology, were astonishing. They had the best collection of data in the United States, and that really pushed forward a lot of understandings of causation and a lot of research. The sort of dark cloud dark lining and the silver cloud is the fact that it was this sort of initiative that really got private health insurance going at a point that public health insurance was beginning to become a possibility. And we've all seen how that played out over the next century. So plus minus, you know, at the time that the programs ran, actually the MetLife programs were quite good. Industrial insurance clientele were buying MetLife because, you know, they could get health insurance as sort of a part of their life insurance. And so those programs actually were quite helpful, but they had a much bigger objective than the programming itself.
I certainly gave this thought as I was going along. I think within the context of progressive Europe, certainly we're looking at a time frame where there was weak public service, public social services. So there certainly was a gap. What I took from these five cases of public-private partnerships is that they allow the promulgators to innovate, to have speed, avoid bureaucracy, and to experiment with different ways of doing things with the hope of eventually obtaining public uptake at a greater scale. From the context of what the other choices were, though, there were none of these, taking these two philanthropists, Vanderbilt and Anderson as an example, they're not following any of the socialist or radical movement. They're not demonstrating for higher wages for workers or, you know, you sort of step back and think, well, was this really a way to solutions, or was this somewhat palliative care, kind of trying to take off the sharpest edges, you know, for the people suffering at the bottom of society? And there were other people who were, you know, more actively trying to radically change the structure. And some historians have said that these types of philanthropy, and Mary and I talked this in regards to Mrs. Harriman and the railroad, did these movements serve to dampen the extremes of conditions and prevent more radical change in the country? And I guess we'll never really know the answer to that.
Okay. I mean, I guess you're getting at some of the question I was really interested in. What kept coming through my mind was Florence Kelly's statement around 1895, where she was, beginning also to take radical activity, and she was trying to distinguish herself from the charity movements that were, that were then dominating social service. I think she said something like that word was, but what's, what charity does is give back a penny out of every dollar they steal from the working class, something like that. And, and then they call it charity. And here she goes about starting all sorts of voluntary organizations and, philanthropic organizations, including Consumers League and all sorts of other things. But I'm just wondering, the first two speakers kind of laid out that question, especially Wolf's paper, where she says, kind of lays out this rubric about whether or not this is a class-conscious attempt at controlling the population, or alternatively, a class-conscious attempt at dividing the population. I'm just wondering, and I guess it's the same question, but where on the spectrum of from social control to actual social welfare do these various voluntary organizations play? I guess it's really the same question for change of answer.
Yeah, I think it's an excellent question. It's one I struggle with, actually. I think the Red Cross occupied a band of the spectrum. And I think, for example, I think the worker first aid programs toward the social control end of the spectrum because they located the problem in the worker himself or herself and said that the problem is the workers need to be educated on safety. They need to pay better attention. They need to learn. Rather than locating the problem in structural conditions. So I feel like to that, that is something about you saying, it's the worker's fault, it's the worker's responsibility. And we all know workers have a certain responsibility, but to say it's that, you know, that's the place where the reform needs to take place, I think is heading toward, you know, better social control of workers, especially when you have these contests where, you know, they're organizing the teams. But the Red Cross, when it came to mining relief, was really a social welfare organization, and there was some social control, but they focused more on providing for the families of the miners over the long period. And I think what's interesting is that you have this mix of the social worker class that's more inclined towards social welfare with a little dose of social control. And you have the leadership class, some of the philanthropists and the people who are, you know, funding and the executive boards who are more inclined toward social control. That's my take it with the Red Cross. And that came out most dramatically with the Ludlow strike, where you had the social worker who actually knew Alice Hamilton saying, yeah, we should go and help the families. And then Judge Payne, who was this Midwestern judge and part of the Democratic elite, friend of Woodrow Wilson's, and kind of, you know, a hoity-toity kind of a figure, saying, no, we can't do that because our funders will get mad, basically.
But did they ever go and challenge industry to demand safety in the workplace?
No, they never, yeah. They never went to, you mean to go and demand that the...
Yeah, to place the blame and the responsibility on, you know, capital rather than on school workers and give them out the charity after they've got...
No, they never did. They never did, and they said, well, we have to be neutral. But if they had to be neutral, then why didn't they go help the workers in the strike? You know, I mean, if they couldn't, you know, if they... So, yeah, I think they were more... And because the people who funded the Red Cross, I mean, the Rockefellers, Mrs. Sage, Mrs. Harriman, a number of other really wealthy people basically gave the money for the capital improvements and the endowment of the Red Cross.
You get a similar contrast between the executives and the social workers in life insurance. I'm particularly intrigued by the people who wound up running the welfare department at Metropolitan Life were specifically social workers. Lee Frankel actually wound up writing a paper, I think it was sort of a defense, the title was something like, quite literally, Why I Left Hebrew Charities for Life Insurance, in which he espouses the ideology of life insurance, this will uplift the poor. But especially if you look at his correspondences, especially with Lillian Wald and with the visiting nurses, he is in this position of trying to get a lot of money from MetLife for projects that needed a lot of money. So there's a constant tug of war between the nurses who want to be paid more and want to be able to visit as many people as they can as often as they need to, and Metropolitan Life, which starts putting up parameters of how often you can visit a pregnant woman, how many visits you can make for postpartum, things like that. So you see all of these social workers coming on and donning this executive, this corporate cap, but then kind of continuing to try to do as much social work in a very altruistic vein as possible underneath this new rubric.
Thanks, Jack.
I want to add two components that I think are very crucial to the discussion and also relevant for today. Right? One is the international aspect. For example, the American Joint Distribution Committee, the Red Cross, I mean, they were going abroad, and I think this also
Bob said, I mean, a lot of the program, the charity workers cut their teeth in the progressive era domestic problems and then went abroad during and after World War I. What I was thinking about was Herbert Hoover, who's this classic example of being the major, you know, one of the major figures involved in provision of emergency supplies and relief to Belgium during World War I, and being the head of the food program, and all of this provision of relief to various refugee groups during World War I. But when it came to the Depression and wanting to provide for impoverished people in the U.S., he drew the line and he said it wasn't the same thing. And that, I don't know if I can really generalize, but it seemed like, at least in these cases, the war refugees were classified as the, quote, deserving poor, and that there was already this dichotomy, the deserving poor, the undeserving poor. And so in Hoover's mind, in the mind of these progressive era reformers, these refugees, the women and children especially, maybe not the men, women and children were deserving poor to an extent. And then when it came to, you know, domestic issues, they actually did look more, he didn't want to provide for people because he felt they were not deserving, unless they'd been victims of disasters. If they'd been victims of economic collapse, then they weren't deserving because they should just pull themselves up by their own bootstraps. So in some ways, ironically, the U.S. international aid that began in World War I was more generous. It was also tied to U.S. foreign policy from the beginning. The Red Cross worked directly with the State Department and it took its orders basically from the State Department as well. And there's a whole different story in Central America than there is in Europe. And I could probably go on about that. But basically, I think it was interesting because there was more generosity abroad than it